And today it's not the same. So this article, this article that we're going to study, learn tonight, just for an overview together, is really, I think it's crucial for us to think about today for ourselves, the challenges that we face in Yiddishkeit, and certainly for our children and for the community. So I guess the most basic question that we have to ask ourselves, oh, let's see who's arriving. Some length of Josh.
Right.
We have an article. Why do some people run away from Judaism, from Yiddishkeit?
It's hard.
It's hard. It's restrictive.
There's stigmas.
Stigmas. I think those are probably, certainly the first ones, are the most immediate ones that come to mind. And I don't mean, by the way, I don't mean, unfortunately, cases of kids who, for various reasons, decide not to be engaged in Yiddishkeit, because there are a lot of different factors there. This is a piece of it.
Yeah, everything's hard except for these Hershey's cases.
But the idea that there are restrictions, there are limits, in a culture where today autonomy is so important, is difficult. It's difficult for our kids. It's difficult for us. You talk about it, let's say, in a medical context. Patient walks into a hospital. Can you tell them what to do and say, do it?
Not a chance.
No. Right? Maybe 50 years ago you could.
100%.
Right? But today you can't.
Right.
Right? You know, you're in a business context, you're consulting, you're advising, but you're not telling somebody what to do. And so the whole idea of, you know, somebody else telling you what to do, and then we have the whole kind of even more trendy issue of choice. You know, like, I don't drink coffee, but I bet some of the people around this, coffee? Some people go to Starbucks. So I've gone to meetings at Starbucks. The number of choices that you have at Starbucks of what you want to get to drink, it's amazing. I'm happy I don't drink coffee, because when I walk in there, I'm like overwhelmed. I'm like, I don't know how many things to choose from.
Like going to an ice cream store like Baskin Robbins or something. There's so many flavors now.
It's for yourself.
Oh, so by the way, that's not a joke. One of the programs that we're doing now with the Academy, with students, we're doing a program on Masorah and the impact of halacha on their lives. And there's actually just a side benefit that we talk about with them that's a huge kind of backlash against this, what you're alluding to, this phenomenon of too much choice. A lot of social psychologists are picking up on that. It's a big thing now that, especially let's say in supermarkets, if you want to sell, they did social psychology studies, you want to sell jelly, don't come to the supermarket and put 36 flavors of jelly, because nobody will buy. Put six and they'll buy one. The limit of choice. It's an interesting piece in and of itself. So the idea of saying, I'm going to be limited is one thing. And then there, the Rav Soloveitchik is alluding to a phenomenon that takes it to a whole nother level of intensity. You know, what happens when, you know, a quarterback, let's say a very gregarious, outgoing quarterback, scores a touchdown? So usually it involves something like this, or some other kind of, you know, celebratory, exciting conclusion. You know, how often is it that somebody's going to make a decision? You know what? I had an opportunity, but I'm not going to take the opportunity. I could have scored that touchdown, but you know what? We'll settle for the field goal for whatever reason. It's so, you know, going against our grain. Our grain tells us, our society tells us, our gut tells us, especially our drive to matter tells us, no, you gotta be the one to score the touchdown all the time. You gotta be the one to get off the bench and get out there and make that game-winning shot, and that's gonna be the hero. You gotta be the hero. And there are so many, you know, like the Horatio Alger's movies, the Rudy's, and the, you know, the hero movies that we talk about. You know, what's a hero? Conquering the odds and being the man that's on the shoulders at the end of the game. And Rav Soloveitchik presents a thesis that challenges that whole assumption. And the question becomes, you know, do we agree with this thesis? How does it speak to us? If we do understand it and agree with us, so how do we incorporate it into our lives in a society that's not necessarily in lockstep with this? So I think these are two big issues, the issue of restrictions and the issue of heroism and who's in the center of the circle, that are really important to talk about. And that's what this piece addresses. We had a meeting in the Kol recently, and one of the questions just happened to come up was, you know, how relevant are the ideas of Rav Soloveitchik from 50 years ago, how relevant are they today? Are they as relevant? Are they different? Is the context different that makes them different?
Well, are they more relevant than Rashi from 1,000 years ago?
Right. Are they more relevant than when he said them even 50 years ago, potentially, based on the circumstances that changed? I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I've thought about this a lot. Like, just in my own, like, learning, like, I find myself reading from Soloveitchik less. I definitely haven't found anyone as, like, I don't know, profound and, like, impactful. Like, no one author today can be as powerful as he was. But I definitely think there are issues today that don't necessarily... I think a lot of what he has to say is very meaningful. I do think there are, like, either topics that he didn't address, you know, postmodern, you know, ideology, things like that, how Judaism should relate to that, stuff like, you know, stuff like this, rebelling against authority. Like, authority was such a given for Soloveitchik, so he never had to address the questions of authority, because it was like, of course, halach man is, you know, subject to the authority of God. So I do think there are certain areas that, like, I would have loved for him to write on, that he didn't, but I definitely think he's... he still has a lot to teach us.
And the other thing is that in addition to the content, there's also the language that maybe, even if some of us are not so philosophically inclined, we can take those yesodos and translate them to language that speaks to us.
I thought you were going to say the other way around.
Yeah.
Nobody can understand them nowadays. I mean, he's hard to understand.
That's right.
I mean, I don't know if 50 years ago people like who were, you know, sort of undergrad at NYU understood what he was talking about.
I have no idea. Did people really know?
But I have no idea what he's talking about.
I heard like Rabbi Brander one time, he was like, just look at like the first footnote in Halachic Man, and it's like literally like full, like references to like different philosophical works spanning like millennia, and like people don't speak that way. No one speaks like, maybe people with PhDs in philosophy understand that, but normal people don't. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that.
He might have been going from a Rambam philosophy that it's, you know, it's not really necessarily meant for the everyday person.
Right.
It's meant for the Rabar Lechtenstein side.
Right. Right. People that first year Rabar Lechtenstein shiur, did they really understand everything he was saying? I mean,
That's why they say the Saturday night shiurim from the Rav were very unique, because he kind of dumbed it down for a little
for
bit.
For the Hamona. Interesting. Yeah, I assume you know people who used to go to that shiur.
Mm-hmm. Unlike Rav Kook, sort of, I think, I imagine so much of his work is so much more relevant and understood in a post-state era than it was when he wrote it.
It's an interesting question. I find that the language, I don't mean no vocabulary, I mean the language of ideas in Rav Kook is so ethereal that it's much more difficult. I have difficulty with Rav Soloveitchik because I'm not philosophically inclined and I'm not trained in the study of philosophy, nor do I carry a dictionary with me at all times. But I think Rav Kook and the ideas, it's so otherworldly that I find it more challenging. Mm-hmm. Just from a...
But I think the way Rav Kook has been... the way the persona of Rav Kook, forget the actual content,
right,
the persona of Rav Kook has been transmitted to, let's say, the modern religious Zionist movement. He is the head. Like, whether that means because people study Orot or Shmona Kvatzim or not at all, but like, they know that he was like a religious Zionist, Big Talmud Chacham.
Right.
You know, versus like Rav Soloveitchik, for us it still always comes back to like Halachic Man or Lonely Man of Faith or things that he wrote, or, you know, his Lamdus, his Shiurim, his Talmidim that are the rabbis around the world and the Rosh Yeshiva NYU. So there's more of a concrete connection. With Rav Kook, there's basically no connection. I mean, he had one son, and his son had no sons.
Right.
So it's a different...
You know.
But he created a language that, you know,
that right. movement has within Israel.
Right.
Right.
I guess the rub did also in terms of...
For sure, here. So let's survey this piece and realize that there is a lot here to take away for us to think about regarding these issues. So the Rav begins with a distinction between koach and gvura. Hanosein layoef koach. What is koach? How would you translate koach?
Strength.
Right. We could call it brute strength. And that's the same brute strength that exists in a wrestler and in an aardvark and in an antelope. It's a physical might. As opposed to gvura, gvura is something else. And this is where he begins. Turn to the next page on 40. Not the bracha of Hanosein lo yoev koach, but the bracha of Ozer Yisrael b'gvura. The victory with which, on page 40, with which gvura is identified is not military victory alone, or indeed any triumph which is merely the result of superior manpower and materials. On the contrary, at times the combatant who is defeated on the field of battle is the one who emerges as the gibor. Victory, victor in a higher historical sense, and not the apparent winner. So what is gvura? If it's not the strength and the victorious. So what is it? He says, you know what gvura is? Gvura is heroism. Heroic life is gvura. And he illustrates this with a gibor, the story of gvura of Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov Avinu fights against this Saro Shel Esav, Rashi refers to him as this anonymous, mysterious man. And Yaakov vanquishes this man. He's the underdog. He's the lonely and helpless guy. And all of a sudden now, he's able to become victorious, despite the fact that all the odds were stacked against him. But what makes him a hero? What's the heroism here? So go to the 42. It says it's not so much that Yaakov Avinu was the physically mighty warrior who came out on top. The mere myth of the hero gave the aesthete endless comfort. At least, the classical aesthete said to himself, there was an individual who dared to do the impossible and to achieve the grandiose. In short, the hero of classical man was the grandiose figure with whom, in order to satisfy his endless vanity, classical man identified himself. Hero worship is basically self-worship. Right? We look up to certain heroes in seeing in ourselves. Like, we imagine Michael Jordan jumping from the foul line, dunking, and we see ourselves... All right, I'm not going to ask people to raise their hands how many people ever imagined this, but maybe we ever imagined ourselves dunking over somebody else. But he says, that's not... What's that?
The baskets.
Right. But that's not the biblical hero. Next paragraph. In contrast to classical aesthetic heroism, biblical heroism, as portrayed in the narrative about Jacob, is not nurtured by an ephemeral mood or a passing state of mind. It is perhaps the central motif in our existential experience. Next line. The individual, instead of undertaking heroic actions sporadically, lives constantly as a hero. Jacob did not just act heroically based upon the spur of the moment. His action was indicative of a resolute way of life. He was not out to impress anybody. This type of heroics lasts as long as man is aware of himself as a singular being. So the first thing is, heroism is not about dunking over someone or an individual achievement. What is it? It's what he says on the next column. The angel is losing. He says, Vayomer Shalcheni ki Allah HaShachar, page 43. But why did Jacob listen to the plea of a man who a short while ago had been determined to annihilate him? The vanquished adversary did not even promise Jacob he would not repeat his attack. To release such a dangerous fiend was, quote, unreasonable. This very unreasonableness endowed the act with the quality of the heroic and may serve as a pattern for halachic heroism. What is heroism in halacha? What does the halacha recommend to us that we may attain heroic stature? The answer is one must perform the dialectical movement. The halachic catharsis expresses itself in paradoxical movement in two opposite directions, in surging forward boldly and in retreating humbly. Man's heroic experience is a polar antithetic one. Man drives forward only to retreat and to reverse subsequently the direction of that movement. So what was the heroism of Yaakov Avinu? It was actually letting him go. It wasn't dunking over him. It wasn't spiking the ball in his face in the end zone. It was letting him leave.
He didn't make him give him a bracha.
Exactly. Ki im berachtani. It's the idea, it's the idea, like the Rambam says, that there is this push-pull. Rambam says in Hilchos Yisodiyah Torah that a person who thinks about the mamash, the amazing love and beauty and majesty of God, you just want to give the Rabbona Shalom Kiviyachol, and you'll excuse me, a gigantic hug. We came to Har Sinai, and what did Moshe Rabbeinu have to say? What did the Rabbona Shalom Rabbeinu have to tell us based on HaKadosh Baruch Hu's comment? Build a fence. Why did the Rosh Hashanah tell them, and he had to tell them repeatedly, build a fence? Because the first thing that people would do when they saw this kind of experience, when they felt the presence of the Rosh Hashanah, would be to rush forward. But then what happens after you really take a moment to think about that overwhelming, awesome presence of the Rabbona Shalom? What do? You end up taking 3 steps back. What happened to the Jewish people at Har Sinai? Instead of moving forward, when the Rabbona Shalom actually showed up, they were so overwhelmed, the Medrash says that they ran backwards. The Rambam says that when a first person that they experienced that Ava, then all of a sudden when they realize the magnitude of the Rabbona Shalom, then they recoil. And it's not a rejection of God, it's part of the ideal experience. There's a darshan, someone was talking to me in shul a couple weeks ago, in the building, not during, I'm just saying. He said he noticed the pasuk says at the end of Parshas Yisro, Lo sasun iti Elohei chesef Elohei zav, Lo sasu lachem, Mizbach adam atasali. So I remember, so he was commenting, he was noting this was interesting words after the Aseret Dibros. I said, I remember that I think it was from Mendel Block when I was in Kerem Yavna, said from some darshanim, he used to say, Lo sasun iti Elohei kesef. The word kesef comes from the word to long for, to yearn, to love. Like it says in the pasuk, Ki nechsof nechsafta lebeis avicha. You really wanted it. So don't make me into the lovey-dovey God. Ve'elohei zav. Don't make me into a God of zav. Gold, the Gemara says there are 2 kinds of gold. There's a reddish gold and a greenish gold. The reddish gold has like a tinge of anger associated with it. Don't make me an angry God. I'm not the God that's all loving, and I'm not the God that's all angry. And I'm not there with a long beard and a lightning bolt trying to get you. But I'm also not the God who's your best friend sitting on the couch. I'm a little bit of both. There is an element of embracing the Rabbona Shalom, and then there's an element of Yiras Haromimus, of awe. So on the one hand, in life, we need to surge forward. We need to do what Adam and Chava were told, which is V'chivshua. That's the next paragraph. Conquer the world. But at the same time, we need to step back. When the Rabbona Shalom, it's interesting, even it's not here, but in it's kind of a similar concept in Adam 1 and Adam 2, not the same way at all, but in the lonely man of faith, the idea that, yeah, on the one hand, we're the Chivshua, we got to go out there and build the world and fix the world and develop it, and on the other hand, we're La'ovda and La'shamra. We're just custodians. At a certain point, we got to step back and say, you know what, Rabbona Shalom, we're done. Comes the Sheishas and Me'amasa to the end, and we say to him, okay, we're going to retreat. We've built as much as we can, and now we're going to step back, we're going to recoil, so that you build it out.
But what does it mean that Hashem has Gevura, like in, as in the Bracha, they're using that verb as to describe His characteristics.
So that's true, that's the second Bracha in Shmoneh Esrei, we say Gevuros. Because Kiviyachol, I don't know what this means, honestly, but the Sfar Makadoshim say that the Rabbona Shalom, God Himself, had to recoil. Because if He let the full Or Ein Sof into the world, we wouldn't be able to exist. We wouldn't exist because it would be just Melocha La'oretz Kavodo. So therefore, the Ribbono Shel Olam, God had to recoil and say, you know what? I'm going to pull back. And that's why the word Shakai, the name of God that is associated sometimes with Midas Hadin, with the Gvura, stands for, according to the Medrash, Sha'amar La'olamo Dai. He said, enough. Yeah, the Ribbono Shel Olam could have gone creating and creating and creating. Adrabah, God recoiled to say, you know what? Give us a chance. You guys go build something in this world. That act, that's what they call in the Kabbalah, whatever this, I don't know what it means, but they call it Tzimtzum. That's Gvura. The Balatanya in the Shaar Yichud V'Emunah talks about exactly that idea. That the Ribbono Shel Olam, he created the world with Chesed, but then he also created it with Gvura by saying, I'm going to recoil. I'm going to be the Gibor, the hero, to say, let somebody else score the touchdown.
So he helps Bnei Yisrael by recoiling?
Yes, by giving us that opportunity. And that's why the Baal HaTanya says that in actuality, that Gvura is actually a Chesed. That's Gvura Sheba Chesed, Chesed Sheba Gvura. It's one with the other. The Ribbono Shel Olam, by saying, you bring godliness into the world, did us a Chesed. So he did the act of recoil, of Gevura, of the Gibor. By doing that, he did us a chesed, but it was really an act of Gevura. And that's the second bracha in the Shemone Esrei. It's Ata Gibor. So what the Rav then does, which is quite interesting, because some of the other pieces, essays that I've read from Rav Soloveitchik, are more theoretical. And here, he actually gets really, like, brass tacks. He gets very practical in examples of recoil. Examples of Gevura. And when we think about these examples, these are the kind of ways where we think about, wow, these are things that are very, very anti the trends in American society and life today, but how heroic does it make us? How much heroism do we achieve by this? So, the first case that he gives us, you see I'm on page 44 in section 2 and number 1. First, he gives us the idea of catharsis through the dialectical movement manifests itself in all halachic norms regarding human life. Nowhere, however, does this doctrine of dialectical catharsis assert itself more frequently than it does in the aesthetic hedonic realm. How does a person withdraw? So he gives you this medrash, the famous medrash of Suga Bashoshanim, that you have a couple who have been dating for who knows how long. The husband is 40 years old, the wife is 30 years old, and they finally, at the end of this long engagement, they're about to consummate their marriage, and the woman says, oh, I saw a speck, I saw a tipas dam, a speck of blood, renders her anita. So the medrash says, what scorpion bit him? What snake bit him that he recoils from her? The answer is, it's the recoil of halacha. It's the gevura, the restraint. You know, a person's driving down the turnpike, and we're mamish hungry. Some of us in this room, and some of us on this call, travel. And that's an unbelievable challenge sometimes when it comes to getting food. Although today, thanks to some of the chains and the hashgachas, it's not so hard as it was years ago. But you know, your mom is starving. You stop at a rest area and you look at a restaurant, and I can't help myself. I mean, that's Cinnabon. It's not kosher, but it looks very much like the kosher one that I know right here in Old Orchard. And I start rationalizing in my mind, well, you know, Bishul Akum, it's really old news. I'm not going to marry the guy's daughter anyway, and I'm just passing through the neighborhood, and blah, blah, blah. But that restraint...
That works.
What's that? But that restraint, that's unbelievable gevura. And you're going to say, yes, that's certainly true, but, you know, it's really passé. But you know what I have to tell you? Not only is it incredibly powerful on a religious level, psychologists have pointed out that this has an unbelievable effect on a person in and of themselves in terms of their success in life. There was this famous study that was done in the 60s called the Marshmallow Test. Right? Awesome. And if you have not seen this, you should go online, go to YouTube for 5 minutes, and watch the Marshmallow Test, where they did this with little kids, and they had a hidden camera in the room. Imagine you have your 5-year-old, you put them in the room, you put one marshmallow on the table, and you say, here's the marshmallow. If you want, you can eat it now. Or if you wait a few minutes, you'll have two. This experiment in the 60s and 70s spawned now a whole secondary series of research. What was the book that I read? There was a whole book on this.
It's called The Marshmallow.
That's what it's called, The Marshmallow Test. Mm-hmm. It's a great, it's like a greenish-colored book. I have it at home. It's amazing, with a marshmallow on it. Awesome. You know what they realized? They realized that the kids who... And now, you watch this. It's amazing. You have some kids that are like... They're touching the marshmallow. They're putting it on their nose. They're like... Some of them are... They're looking like this. Some of them are eating it. The kids who are able to restrain themselves, to cultivate that ability of gvura, they've done decades of longitudinal studies across all socioeconomic levels to see the impact that it has on them in terms of their ability to succeed financially, socially, staying away from substance abuse. Every metric that you can imagine is much higher, noticeably higher. Now, I don't believe that that the Rebbe Shlom gave us the Torah as the marshmallow test self-help book. That's not why God gave us the Torah. But if what Rav Soloveitchik is saying is that what differentiates human beings from animals is not the koach, it's the gevura, then it makes sense that a person who develops gevura develops themselves as a proper, highly functioning person. It's not a self-help manual, but it certainly affects how we are as people. To be able to control that impulsivity, you know, the two mechanisms in the brain, there's the cool side of the brain and then the hot side of the brain, to be able to navigate and modulate those in this meaningful way, that's really important. That's crucial. And that's what develops us as a person. So it's easier, a little bit easier for us to appreciate this. It's much harder for our kids, right? Take a five-year-old. It's much harder for him to take the marshmallow toss than for us. We know we're going to get to. But even for us, it's difficult. And what Rav Soloveitchik is calling us to is heroism. His true heroism is gevura. So in the first aspect is hedonic. We want to eat that. We want to take that to pleasure. And we hold back based on the halachic parameters that we have. Then he...
Something that we start instilling in our kids at a relatively young age. You know, I'm sorry, you said hot dog, you can't have the ice cream kind of thing.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, your kids through like Costco, and they have like all those things that they're handing out. And I remember talking to kids, they can't have it. They're like, oh, okay. And like a mother right next to me was like, how did you do that?
Or how many times have you lied to your kids in the store when you didn't want to?
Oh, this is not kosher. But you know what?
Oh, I didn't tell the lady it was kosher. I said, oh, they listen to me all the
time. But truth to tell, by the way, it's an amazing thing. Think about that. Think about that. That is an incredible chinuch achievement. That if we tell our kids it's not kosher, they will listen to us more readily than if we just tell them as parents, no, you can't have that.
Completely true. Rosh Hashanah definitely.
That's right. You know what? I think they're thinking of themselves as cathartic beings.
They know it's non-negotiable.
That's it. And you know what? But you know what? We should take a step back and realize how gevaldic that is. And we shouldn't take that for granted. Because we didn't have to be that way. A lot of people choose not to do it. A lot of people choose not to do it because they see that as an imposition on the autonomy that Western civilization has told them is core of their being. But Rav Soloveitchik is saying, you're right, autonomy of course is part of your core being, but that's not what defines you. What defines you is your ability to take that autonomous self and make a choice that's heroic. That's what's gevura. He gives you another example, even more intense. An inner withdrawal of emotion. Page 47. Catharsis in the emotional sphere. Let me illustrate the halachic idea, he says, of inner withdrawal or emotional catharsis. Aaron the high priest met with disaster on the most joyous day of his life. When the tabernacle was dedicated, he was inaugurated into his office. Two of his sons died. Death is always the great evil which man cannot accept. It is certainly unacceptable to a father whose grief over the loss of a son is limitless. How much more so the unreasonable death of two sons who had entered the sanctuary to worship and to serve the Lord and were devoured by a fire. And what is Aaron HaKohen called upon to do? Moshe Rabbeinu says to him, I'm sorry. Rashaychem al tefru b'gdeichem lo sefrum v'lo samusiv al kol oida yiktov achichem kol yisbeis Yisrael yivku es esreifa. So you got to just button it up and go on with the service. You can't mourn. What do you mean you can't mourn? That's an inalienable right, says Rav Soloveitchik. Was denied to Aaron. Go to 48. And despite all of this, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted Aaron HaKohen to disown the strongest emotion in man, the love for a child. Is it possible? As far as modern man is concerned, I would not dare answer. With respect to biblical man, we read that Aaron acted in accordance, in accord with the divine instruction. Vayasu Kedvar Moshe. But it's not just Aaron HaKohen. So Rav Soloveitchik now gives an example. Now,
Aaron was commanded to stand still?
Yeah. Part of it was Vayidom Aaron, that was on his own, but he couldn't express any Avelos.
Oh, okay. I thought, because I remember when we give him credit.
Yes, that's the Vayidom Aaron.
Yeah, okay, but on top of that.
On top of that, he couldn't express in any way what we would call Nihugi Avelos. And now he gives another example. Now, I'm not sure, I don't know if this is, we could say, autobiographical, but you should know that Rav Soloveitchik, in 1 year, he lost his mother, his brother, and his wife. And his wife died on Tanis Esther right before Purim. So Rav Soloveitchik describes here a person who loses a close relative, and this happens, loses a close relative, unfortunately, right before a Yontif. I'm on the bottom of 48 on the left-hand side. On the let's take an example. We all know the law that a festival suspends the mourning for one of the seven intimate relatives. So what happens? A person loses their close relative, is buried on Erev Yontif. And yet, then the night of Yontif arrives and they have to fulfill the mitzvah of V'samachta b'chagecha. Look on page 49. It's so powerful. Let's visualize the concrete scene about 8-10 lines down. The mourner who has buried a beloved wife or mother returns home from the graveyard where he has left part of himself, where he has witnessed the mockery of human existence. He is in a mood to question the validity of our entire axiological universe. The house is empty, dreary. Every piece of furniture reminds the mourner of the beloved person he has buried. Every corner is full of memories. Yet the halacha addresses itself to the lonely mourner, whispering to him, "Rise from your mourning, cast ashes from your head, change your clothes, light the festive candles, recite over a cup of wine the Kiddush, extolling the Lord for giving us the festivals and gladness, say Shechianu, etc." 3 lines later, the halacha, which at times can be very tender, understanding, and accommodating, may on other occasions act like a disciplinarian, demanding obedience. The halacha suggests to man, broken in body and spirit, carrying the burden of an absurd existence, that he change his mood, that he cast off his grief and choose joy. Let us repeat the question. Is such a metamorphosis of the state of mind of an individual possible? Can one make the leap from utter bleak desolation and hopelessness into joyous trust? Can one replace the experience of monstrosity with the feeling of highest meaningfulness? I have no right to judge. However, I know of people who attempted to perform this greatest of all miracles. And then finally, he moves on in this next section, in number 3, in the intellectual realm, the logical realm, the scholar. This is very much the experience that we have sometimes in Talmud Torah, and this is what Rav Soloveitchik describes. On the one hand, we surge forward. We learn the Gemara. You open a Gemara, you start on Daf Beis, you get somewhere, you're figuring out the Havamina, you're getting along the way, you got an insight, you figured out a question, you got an answer. Then you get to one step in the Gemara. You know what the Gemara does? It shuts you down. It tells you everything that you thought until now is totally wrong. And you know what you have to do? You have to accept defeat. You thought it was such a good svara going forward, and then the Gemara says, no, we're going to go a different direction. Isn't that so much of what the experience of Gemara is about? And that's part of the reason that sometimes so many people are so frustrated by the Gemara. Because they're not interested in the momentum of the dialectic, of surging forward, of saying, I got this, and then realizing, you know what? You don't got it. That's so challenging. But at the same time, that's That's what it's all about. Let's go to 4, page 52, and with this we'll close it out. Man must be ready to accept defeat not only in the carnal aesthetic, emotional or intellectual world, but also in the moral religious world, in his relationship with God. Man must be capable of recognizing that he is subject willy-nilly to the dialectical movement even in his close encounter with God. Even when he is certain that God is close to him, and all he has to do is make the final leap to embrace to the embrace of his Maker, there is an unredeemed moral and religious experience, as there is an unredeemed body and an unredeemed logos. Let us be candid. If one has not redeemed his religious life, he may become self-righteous, insensitive, or even destructive. The story of the Crusades, the Inquisition, and other outbursts of religious fanaticism bear out this thesis. Judaism has sanctioned man, has stated that there is a spark of divinity in man. Judaism has never subscribed to the philosophy that man is intrinsically sinful. On the contrary, turn to page 53. We have taught that the moral challenge which confronts man and the opportunities afforded to him are unlimited. But at the same time, we rush toward God, and yet, even though we rise, then we fall. Next paragraph. Catharsis of religious life consists exactly in the awareness of the long interludes during which man finds himself at an infinite distance from God. The periodic states of ecstasy engendered by the feeling of closeness to God alternate with the states of black despair, which the prophet encounters during moments of exile from the presence of the Almighty, what he calls Hester Panim. On the one hand, we reach forward to the Rabbona Shalom at Maimon Har Sinai. On the other hand, we experience Hester Panim. And this is what we're struggling with. We struggle to be able to recognize that this too is part of the experience. That man must be cognizant of this tragic fact which sooner or later he must encounter if his metaphysical destiny is to be realized. Great is not the man who has never faltered, but the man who tripped, fell, and rose again to greater heights. So the idea of moving forward and then falling back because of our own shortcomings, but not giving up. Part of the challenge sometimes, you talk about raising our children, talking about educating our community, and building a Torah society, is one that deals with setbacks. You know, sometimes people say, you know, you can hear from someone who says, you know, I gave it up because, well, once I violated that, I knew there was, you know, I did this, so then nothing else mattered. Rav Soloveitchik says that's not true. You can surge forward. Even if you fall back, then you surge forward again. It's not an all or nothing proposition. And the idea that, you know, the concept that he frames of recoiling, of heroism, is framed in this other light. It's not exactly parallel to the previous three, but it's a similar concept where, yes, we move forward to accomplish. Sometimes we're going to fall back. Why do we fall back? Because we're human. But at the same time, we need to continue to move forward again. So I think just to summarize this idea, to come back to where we started, the idea of being restricted, of being limited, is an opportunity for us to express our heroism in the way that we lead our lives. And heroism is that ability to navigate the dialectic, to be able to move forward on all areas of life, but to be able also to recoil, to retreat, when we reach those limits that the Rabbona Shalom gave us in each of those contexts. That's what we got.